6 o'clock. We seem to have a sufficient number of people here, so I'm going to call this meeting of the Champaign County Board Committee of the Whole to order. If the clerk would call the roll, please.
Ammons.
Present.
Anderson.
Here.
Beckett.
Here.
Denzel. Betts.
Here.
Carter. Cowart.
Present.
Dennis.
Here.
Gladney.
Present.
James.
Here.
Jay.
Here.
Jones. Knott.
Here.
Kurtz.
Here.
Langenheim. McGinty. Michaels. Mosier. Nudo.
Here.
O'Connor.
Here.
Richards.
Here.
Rosales. Sapp.
Here.
Schrader.
Here.
Schmucker. Weibel.
Yes.
Wysocki.
Here. We do indeed have a quorum. Mr. Weibel?
Well, I'm not at the Ron Brunzel, let me know she's out of town on business.
So noted. Okay, I need a motion to approve the County Board resolution to meet as a committee of the whole.
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Mr. Beckett with a second from Mr. Betts. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. We have four sets of minutes to approve. The chair would entertain an omnibus motion. Mr. Betts.
As a section. I'll make the motion.
Thank you. Seconded by Mr. Kurtz.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just want a clarification. If we were not on the committee at the time, and these were not done as a whole, it's perfectly okay to have a non-member do it?
Yes.
Okay. That was all I wanted to ask.
Anything else? All those in favor of the minutes as presented signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. I need a motion to approve the agenda for this evening. Moved by Mr. Kurtz, seconded by Ms. Ammons. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next is public participation. For the benefit of the folks sitting here, if you do want to speak to the committee, you need to fill out one of these little white forms that I assume are over by the door in order to be recognized. So let's start with Mr. Harold Charlow. Identify yourself, your name and your location, please.
My name is Harold Charlow. I live at 3610 North Lincoln Avenue in Urbana, and we live around the proposed site for the new Olympia Drive project, and I know that is not on the transportation's docket in the near future, but we would like to start early giving our side of this issue. First of all, I'd like to invite all the board members at any time to call any one of us, any of the residents here, come out and visit the site where this road is going to be, look at our location, because I think if you see it and you see the surrounding area, you will realize that a lot of the things that are in the transportation plan are just totally incorrect. On page number 9.7 of the land use plan, there's a map showing the average daily traffic in the county, and it's shown as existing conditions and trends reported as of January 14, 2008. On this map, it shows that as of January 14, 2008, between 400 and 2,100 cars per day uses Fort Harris Road, and that between 2,101 and 6,600 cars per day uses Leverett Road. Now, if anybody has ever been up there, those figures are so out of whack. You couldn't count 100 cars a day on either of those roads, and that's including the residents just going back and forth to work. I don't know where they came up with that number, and that's one of the things I think, as board members, you need to question, how did you determine these numbers? Where did these numbers come from? But even if you accept the low number of these proposals, I calculate at 400 cars a day, that's 17 cars an hour using Fort Harris Road. And on Leverett Road, it calculates 88 cars an hour. Are we going to spend $27 million to build to accommodate that many cars per hour? It makes no sense. The only thing you can think of is growth. But where is that growth going to come from? I've lived here for almost 30 years. I look at Route 45. There has been zero gain in businesses around 45 except for O'Brien Auto Parts. Some businesses have moved out. Other ones have moved in. But I cannot think of any net gain around Route 45. So what is this road going to be used for? Who's going to use it? People from Champaign and the northern side of Urbana going to the mall on Neal Street and going to Prospect Avenue certainly aren't going to drive to Cunningham Avenue to get up there. And even people at Cunningham Avenue, if you're sitting at the stoplight at Cunningham Avenue and Route 74, you make a left-hand turn and you go right to Neal Street, you go right to Prospect Avenue. To use this road, you would have to go through two existing stoplights, the one at O'Brien's and the one at Farm and Fleet, drive a mile and a half further north, go across Olympia Drive, then drive another mile and a half back to either the mall or to Prospect Avenue. To me, it's not going to happen. It just doesn't make sense. And I know of no projects going on either side of Route 45 that would make this plan feasible at all. And then at one of the Urbana City Council meeting when we were there, when they were approving the plan, we had several people talk about job creation. And yes, the highway would create jobs. But for the county board, using money to repave existing highways and making them better for the residents is going to create jobs also. And I just can't believe that anybody for a 1 or 2 year job growth, because they would end after the road is constructed, but would take actually about 85 acres of good farm ground out of production for the forever. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Bill Ziegler.
Good evening. I'm Bill Ziegler. I live on Willow Road, north of Urbana. I want to speak also to the Olympian Road project, more of the history of the area where that road is slated to go across. My wife, Virginia, and I live on our Centennial Farm, located in Section 28 of Summer Township. Our farm has been in the Ziegler family for 145 years. My brother Gene and his wife Mary also live on our farm. I'm still actively engaged in farming this land with my son Scott, who is the fifth generation of the Ziegler family farmers. The proposed Olympian Road project is planned to have the Olympian Road cross our land just north of the quarter line, which would dissect the farm right across the middle of the land. To the west in section 29, the Olympian Road would dissect the Squire Farm, which is also a centennial farm. This area north of Urbana is rich in historical value dating back to the time the University of Illinois was started as a land-grant university in 1867. There have been many Indian artifacts recovered on both the Ziegler and the Squire farms. And there is wood and timber on our land, and a wooded area on the east side of Section 28 would be partially destroyed if the Olympian Road is built as proposed. There are three existing roads in the immediate vicinity of the proposed Olympian Road. To the south, within a mile and a half, is I-74. To the north, 1.5 mile, is the Fort Harris Road. And a mile and a half north is the Leverett Road. It seems like a waste of taxpayer money to build another very expensive road, an estimated $27 million, when there are already three roads close by. I would ask that the county board give this proposed project serious scrutiny to determine that it will be a needless waste of funds to proceed with this road. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Owenson.
Hi, I'm Howard Erlinson. I live at 4132 North Lincoln Avenue, which is also in Summer Township. My wife's family has lived on the farm there for over 100 years. When you drive north on Lincoln Avenue and go over Interstate 74, you'll see mountains of rubble and heavy truck traffic. Then you'll come to a sign that says Old Lincoln Avenue. You'll make a right turn, go around a couple sharp curves, and then you'll come to a T-intersection, and you'll turn left and go north. Then you might see a deer, corn, goats, or a beautiful sunset. The question I'd like you to ask yourself is, which one of these views would you like to have your children and your grandchildren see? Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Mr. William Cope?
Thank you very much. My name is Bill Cope, and I moved here from Australia 3 years ago. I work at the U of I, and so does my wife. And when I came here, I bought a very beautiful piece of land, about 19 acres, of a mixture of old-growth forest and an old tree farm. And I built a house there, and some of you may remember a couple of years ago or so I came here, and there was some rezoning and whatever. So that's who I am. I'm at number 4018 North Lincoln Avenue. I knew this road was going to happen, because when I bought the land, it was on the drawings, but I was told that it would unlikely happen for quite a long time because it was such an expensive thing. With our neighbours and the people in the community, we've been a bit surprised by how quickly this has happened. I mean, the availability of funds to build a very expensive road and what I think is a classical road to nowhere in a number of senses. So let me just talk about that for a few moments. One thing we've done as a group is we thought we're not opposed to development, we're not opposed to roads, we're not opposed to all those objectives, and we tried to come up with a sensible compromise. So what we did is we got Tom Burns, who was in fact came with me when I came here to do the rezoning, to do a drawing of how it might be possible to extend Lincoln through and across the railroad line to join up the existing Olympian Drive. So that cost us a bit of money, and we decided it was just to make a constructive suggestion about what we may do. A number of things about this road. Firstly, it strikes me as being a very bad design. If you look at the plan, you've got to go north on Lincoln. The idea is to bring the traffic from Super Value and in that little industrial zone just to the north of 74 there, and give it a way to cut across to 57 without having to go on 74 to do it. Well, maybe you don't need to do that, but anyhow, if you did need to do it, the way the plan goes, it goes up and heads way to the west before it starts heading before it starts heading to the west. So it's got a big dog leg in it, and it seems to be a very peculiar way to meet that objective. And we think the design that we've done, which I don't know whether you have copies of it or we can get you copies of it, the one that Tom Burns did, is a better and cheaper way to meet those objectives. But also, as a couple of the previous people said, it goes through environmentally sensitive zones, wildlife corridor, fragments of the Big Grove are going to have to come down as the road's built. But importantly, it's a road which doesn't seem to have a huge amount of purpose, which actually takes over 85 acres of some of the world's best farming land. It's a huge right of way in the plan, perhaps because in some time in the future the idea is to increase it, make it even wider, but also digging big holes in the ground to build the bridge over the railroad line and retention ponds and whatever. It's part of a plan where the overall transportation plan is eventually to build a ring road, you know, and this would be part of a ring road that includes that goes right around the town, some small bits of which are produced. And the transportation plan shows that it will lead to more miles driven, more fuel used, because people, instead of going from A to B inside the town, will drive to the edge and then drive very fast around the outside. And that doesn't seem to be a very good, you know, in terms of the way our objectives around the environment and fuel and accidents and stuff, that doesn't seem to be a very good way to deal with our transportation problems. Well, not problems, I don't think we have transportation problems here, transportation issues. But also what it will do, it's designed to produce, you know, industrial development around the road on this farming land, and the people who are here have said that they won't sell. A lot of people are there that won't sell. But I... If you drive to the other end of Olympian, I want you to do this sometime, the far western end, it's just a set of roads that go nowhere. I mean, a set of crossroads and stop signs, and right in the middle of it is a traffic signal blinking red for no cars. So if you want to see the future of what they're proposing to do at the Urbana end, already we have a whole pile of industrial land at the Champagne end which is simply wasted, not used, and seems to me to be very little prospect that will be used. So the objectives around increasing industrial development, let's wait till all the other land is filled up and that stuff is actually used. I mean, you know, again, it's not a matter of being opposed to industrial development. Let's use the land that we have before we create opportunities for sprawl and spreading things out and wasting even more land as we go on. You know, just by way of conclusion, you know, this, as somebody else mentioned, immediately above this road, you know, half a mile or so to the north, we have Leverett Road, which is well used and a good road. To the south, we've got I-74. Why every few hundred yards or half a mile we have to have another major road is beyond me. And this, in a way, is a classic road to nowhere. If you look where it goes from to, it starts at the Walmart and it ends up at the adult store on Route 45. So the three people a day who need to go from Walmart to the adult store will be the users of it, when there are already these quite substantial and not overused roads immediately to the south and immediately to the north. So it just strikes me that spending $27.5 million on this is just not bad in terms of planning, in terms of the environment, in terms of whatever, but also an extraordinary, classic, scandalous waste of money, actually. And I think that go and look at the other end of Olympian Drive to see perhaps what a waste of money that was when it crosses the other side of 57. So, anyhow, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. That's all the requests I have for the public. So I will declare public participation is closed. I do want to say to those of you who are here in support of this issue that there is nothing on the agenda this evening to discuss Olympia Drive or North Urbana or anything else. You're welcome to stay, but I just don't want you sitting there anticipating a full-blown discussion on this topic this evening. Thank you. Okay. Communications from the board. Nothing? Okay. Highway and Transportation. I will be joined by Ms. Cowart, the chair of this committee.
Okay, the Highway and Transportation Committee. We have a monthly report for the county and town motor fuel tax claim for November 2009 and December 2009.
I move we accept and place on file.
Okay, any discussion? Al Kurtz.
Second.
Oh, it was already seconded by John J. Okay, no discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Next item is county engineer report. Yeah, Mr. Cooper.
Good evening. Jeff couldn't make it, and so I'm here to take his place for one day here. This is requesting a resolution to award a contract to Newell's Construction for replacement of a bridge on the county line with Vermillion, which is located just south of Homer. There's a map that I put on everyone's desk to show you the location. There's a copy of the bid in the booklet, and it shows that we're about 10% under the engineer's estimate. This is a TBP or Township Bridge Program bridge that we're constructing, and it's to be constructed probably this spring. So.
Move approval.
Second.
Open for discussion. Ryan.
Mr. Cooper, is this bridge in Champaign County totally?
It will be under our the township jurisdiction when it's completed.
So the question is Vermillion County going to pay for it?
They're participating in it on their share based on
That's the standard. How much are they paying?
Between 5 and 10%.
Okay, thank you.
Any more discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay, going to other business. Is there anything else to go from the Highway Committee? Tom?
In terms of this Olympia Drive issue, do you know when this issue roughly is going to come up?
No, I don't.
No, we haven't had any information about that ourselves either.
I guess my assumption was there was no money sitting around to cover it, but
no money, not yet. Any more discussion? The chair having had a report, and there's only one thing on the agenda that can be placed on our consent agenda, and that's 8B. And that's all I have for the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Court. Mr. Beckett?
Facilities Committee, I entertain a motion to approve the recommendation for chiller replacement at the Downtown Correctional Center.
So moved.
Moved by Betts, second by Ammons. Mr. Reinhart, do you want to explain what's happened with the Downtown Correctional Center and the need for chiller replacement?
Toward the end of the last cooling season, late July, we experienced failures with the two bundles in our large chiller and a heat exchanger in our small backup chiller. We were able to replace one part of the heat exchanger on the backup chiller to finish cooling through the final part of the cooling season. We disassembled a large cooler chiller, determined that over 60% of the tubes in the chiller itself were beyond repair. So at that point, it is well over 20 years old, and it is served its useful life.
Has it exceeded its projected life from its original placement?
Could I defer that to Mr. Gleason?
Sure.
You've definitely gotten your money's worth out of the chillers. Both the chillers, which were not installed at the same time, I might add, have exceeded their statistical life by some considerable amount. At this point, it's kind of odd we're sitting here worrying about cooling when it's like this, but we got to get ahead of the curve on this. So.
Well, you know, two questions occurred to me. One is, besides replacing the chiller, what alternative do we have?
You don't.
Okay. And the second question I have is a matter of timing in terms of specifications, bid process, obtaining materials, and getting the work done before the cooling season comes into play.
This is probably the most critical part of the project. The lead time on chillers of this type, replacement chillers, is 12 weeks, and we've verified that by phone call just a week ago. In order to get the machine purchased on site and installed by something around mid-May, we really need to do things a little bit different than we normally would. And what we've proposed is that the county would bid the chiller, in other words, purchase the chiller, at the same time as we prepare construction documents to install the chiller. The concept here is that the county would get the ball rolling, we'd take the purchase order for the chiller, hand it to the contractor, tell him, here, this is going to be your chiller when it gets here, you're going to be responsible for the warranty, here's what you're going to pay for it, put that in the bid.
Do we save contractors' markup by buying the chiller ourselves as opposed to going through the contractor to buy it?
You would if you continued to own the chiller, which I do not recommend. I did this once in my life, and I vowed never to do it again when it conked out at 2 o'clock in the morning and they called me. You want the contractor to be responsible for the warranty. They're the ones that are going to install it, so you really don't want to have them installing your equipment.
Okay.
And being responsible, then you're both still responsible for it. So we'd recommend a mechanism by which the responsibility is retained in the hands of the contractor.
Do you have any other comments?
No, I don't.
Question, Ms. Ammons.
Do contractors normally want their customer to... Just two of them. On the paperwork here, it says phase one, replace chiller. Phase two, replace second chiller. Are we saying that there are two chillers that we need to purchase for this facility?
Let me answer your last question first. I prepared some phasing options here in case sufficient money wasn't available to replace both chillers at the same time. There are two chillers there. They are of unequal size. They were installed at different time frames. One's like 5 years older than the other one. The smaller chiller is not able to carry the load by itself. So it's not even an option to go on with just that single chiller there, and no backup, by the way, which is a critical part of this whole concern here. Because of the nature of that building, if the cooling goes down, you're going to have to move people out of there. So that's, I'm trying to answer your last question first. In terms of what contractors would normally like to see, I don't really think they care what it is as long as they know what it is. So typically, and we've done this before on fast-track projects like this, that purchase order that's negotiated with a chiller manufacturer based on specifications for performance and all this will be bound into the contract documents, the bid documents, for the contractors. So now they're looking at it and saying, okay, I see I'm going to get a XYZ chiller. It's going to cost this much. They're going to deliver it at this location. It has these features and functions and so on. And that works very successfully. It's a good question, though.
Mr. James.
And they will put a slight markup on it, by the way, to handle the paperwork and so on.
Looking at your paperwork here, and I just briefly went through it again, but you're talking about water-cooled versus air-cooled. And the savings really isn't that great with water-cooled. When they spec this job, are they going to specify which they would prefer, or is there any inkling on that? And then also, in follow-up, as an option, sometimes when I used to spec jobs, I would throw in, you're talking about the second chiller, my thought is that when they're up there working, and if they have an option to replace the other one on the table at that time, because as we all know, if they have to come back later, the cost of labor and resetting up is going to be added in at
Excellent.
That time, so your cost savings out the window. So I always sort of build in an option to put that out there just to see what the number may be.
we would like to have firm direction from this group as to how many, whether we're going to do phase one and two, or phase one, two, and three. I believe you're looking at the combined phase one, two, three option. I'll defer to these folks to tell me that. In response to whether we'd go water-cooled or air-cooled, the recommendation, quite honestly, is to go air-cooled. It has a number of compelling advantages to it, primarily the backup feature. If we stayed with water-cooled, of course, it costs more up front. Very slight decrease in operating costs, but if you look at the life cycle costs, you never recover from energy savings the additional dollars that you had to shell out for all the equipment, and the tower is what does it. The tower is always the weak link in the analysis because there's only one of them. If the tower fails, it doesn't matter when you've got water-cooled equipment. You're out of action. If you go the air-cooled, they're completely independent systems. One can die, and the other one will carry the load just fine. So the recommendation is to use air-cooled.
So the committee understands. The motion I believe to be on the floor is to accept the recommendation for all three phases of an air-cooled chiller system. Okay? So somebody can change that motion if they want, but that's my understanding of the motion that's on the floor. Mr. Nudo.
Thank you. This is directed to Deb. What are the long-term prospects of ownership of that building? I know we have plans at some point to move the operation closer to the other.
That is a question for the board, but in terms of long-term financial planning, we have anticipated that by 2013, we might be looking at replacing the downtown beds at the satellite jail, which was designed and is built so that it can be expanded so that you would have your entire jail operation under one
roof.
More
efficient, yeah.
And that has always been anticipated in the long-term plan for the public safety sales tax funds, but that is not a decision that this board has made or given direction.
Right. And I also realize that the decision to put in a chiller is immediate, and it has no bearing on whether we do what you're wanting to do in 2013 or not. But having said that, the new user of that building will have will gut the inside. It's never going to be a jail again. It's going to be probably office or something similar to that. My question about a chiller with the interior piping and everything like that, just what will be the intrinsic value of that chiller to the next owner, or will they have to scrap that and put something else in?
I would doubt very much that they'd scrap the investment in the new chiller.
And the venting, they have to change all the venting to fit offices. What would you estimate
if you separate the functions of ventilating from cooling?
Well, I don't think you can in this.
Well, clearly, the stuff that comes out of these grills,
right,
you'd set that up differently for an office than you would for a prison, for jail. But the cooling source can still be the same. That source is delivered through pipes that are pumped around, and that can easily be changed. So if the question boils down to will there be some long-term value to this investment, the answer is yes, even if the building function changes.
Yeah, and you would have some devaluation of the building by virtue of the fact they would recognize they got to do reventing, and so the price of the building that we'd sell it for would be less because of that use. But I don't deny we need to do this.
Mr. Richards.
Ms. Busey, Mr. Reinhardt, have we had any success in following up with Carol Kulik at DCEO about energy efficiency grants to help pay for this?
No, we had not.
No? Okay. And I guess for any of you, where are we thinking we're going to find the money to pay for this?
Well, that's something that after tonight's actions, we will be placing on the finance agenda next week for discussion. There are, a couple of options. One is to look at the public safety sales tax fund, which could, you would have to look at the plan long term for those funds and see whether or not this is an expenditure you would want to appropriate from there, to look at the general corporate fund and or to consider issuing debt for this expense. And after tonight's action, we will have some form of ideas or, options for you to look at next week.
Thank you.
Mr. Betts.
Okay.
Chair Weibel.
Let's say in 2013, we decided not to remodel the building. It's a nice offices like Mr. Noodle has recommended, or has thought about. But instead, it's decided to demo the building. Will that unit be salvaged to be used somewhere else? What do you think?
Could you pull the chillers out of the building and use them someplace else? Yeah. Yes, you could.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a follow-up question. Can we solve the present emergency by adopting phase one and putting phase two and phase three on the side, waiting to see if our financial condition changes?
Yes, you could. The downside of that is you're still married to a cooling tower, which itself is well past its projected life. But yes, you could. And in fact, that's why I put phase one together, was to illustrate that, yes, it is possible to do it this way.
Mr. Gladney.
So you're saying that the contractor would own the chiller, correct?
Correct.
What if the contractor were to go out of business? What would happen to the...
We're going to talk about that later this evening.
Yeah.
Well, you'd pay him for it,
okay. But
he would handle the paperwork. So you would end up owning the chiller by paying him.
Once we pay the contractor, it's ours.
Correct.
So we have the warranty in place because he installed it.
Correct.
Chair Weibel.
Going back to what Mr. Beckett talked about, if we just do phase one, you talked about the tower. The tower would only be used for the backup system, though, correct?
Correct.
So that's only if the new system fails.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Knott.
I just, to think a little longer term, though, even if in 2013 or 14 we put a referendum on the ballot, you're still talking 2 to 3 years to get it done. You know, you're almost still talking 10 years here.
Yeah. I don't think we have to put a referendum on the ballot.
Well, whatever would be.
Right. We have public safety bonding authority where we can come up with the money for that major construction project if the county board thought that was the right thing to do.
Right.
So there's no referendum required.
But we'll still be 5, 6, 7 years out. So it's not like in a year we're going to abandon the...
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Gleason.
My last question is, understanding the, as expressed in the document, the sense of urgency.
Right.
I'm not clear on where we would get the money, so why I would approve such an expenditure, I knew where the money was coming from.
Well, because that's the way our committees work. We have decisions that are made in facilities. We have decisions that are made in finance. Unfortunately, facilities meets before finance. Okay? And just because you approve the project tonight to go forward, put it on the county board, that's the one beauty, I think, of this committee, the whole structure. You literally could approve this, and you could say, okay, I'll consider that finance thing and approve it out of finance, and you still have that final vote when the two things come together at the county board meeting. And so, in essence, what you're saying is, I'm keeping the project alive, I see the need for it, but that doesn't mean that because I vote for it tonight, I'm, quote, married to that vote. Mr. Smith.
I'd like to call a question.
Okay. Any other discussion? Anybody opposed to calling the question? Seeing no objection? All right. Does everybody understand the motion on the floor is all phases? All right? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay, the motion carries. Let's see. Approval of amendment. I guess I need you to hang around, Mr. Gleason, if you didn't go anywhere. Approval of amendment to the current GHR contract for Phase 2 construction services for chiller replacement. I'll entertain a motion to approve. Moved by Richards. Second by Weibel. We contracted with GHR to do an energy efficiency analysis of HVAC at a couple of our buildings, including the downtown jail. You've seen what the recommendation is about the downtown jail, what we need. Now, we need engineers to carry that project forward, Mr. Jay. And the question is, do we amend the... I'm just picking on you. The question is, do we amend the existing agreement that we have with GHR to include this project, which is probably a $50,000 item, isn't it? Am I far off?
It's in the neighborhood.
Okay. Or do we do a RFP and have one of our searches for engineering services? And when I met with Deb and Alan about this, it was my recommendation that we move forward with GHR. They're already involved in the work. It's an emergency situation. We may lawfully do so at your desk. You should have a...
Does everybody have this?
You should have an email where I had a discussion by email with Dave DeThorne to indicate that this is not... It's not required that we do an RFP. The concern that I have about the RFP is that literally it'll take us a month to select, and then we have to negotiate with an engineer about the services that they would have to do, and we just don't have the time. If we're going to meet the cooling season, we don't have the time. So that's the issue. Discussion. Mr. J. Nope. Okay. Hearing none? Yes, Ms. Ammons.
Yes, unfortunately, I have not had an opportunity to read this.
Okay. Well, I can explain it. Sure. The reason why I raised the issue was to make sure that our attorney said that we may lawfully amend this contract to have GHR provide the engineering services we need on this project. This is long, but it says yes, we may lawfully do so.
And so you asked for this opinion because we would be in violation of our purchasing requirements based on amount?
Nope.
Okay, tell me.
I asked for this opinion because I thought if I didn't, I'd get to this meeting and somebody would say, may we lawfully do this? And I wanted to anticipate that question and make sure that I had the advice in place that said, yes, we can. So again, I'm not the lawyer. I'm the client. So I asked our lawyer. Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. Okay. Courthouse exterior clock and bell tower renovation project. Project update, Mr. Reinhart.
Project update on page 55. Ms. Busey has submitted the current project balance sheet to date.
And I think, committee members, haven't we received that and placed it on file? Is that right?
Yeah.
So I'll entertain a motion to receive it and place it on file.
So moved.
By Ben, second by Covert. Any discussion about the project update? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay. Item number two, report on south side replacement.
You should have received a report.
Sheet right here. Got it? All right.
Okay. At the end of this season, they were finishing up installing the last pieces of stone designed to be replaced on the south side of the courthouse, which was never intended to be as ornate as the north front and the west side. We've seen a serious problem with the type of the stone did not match the existing stone. The new replacement stone did not match the existing stone on the south side of the building. It was the first indication. Second problem that came up was that the stone that was left in place by design was in worse shape than what was initially anticipated. So we have put new stone all the way around the front, around the side, and when we got to the back, we just stopped and just started putting a piece here and there. We asked the our architects to tell us, in their opinion, what were the best recommendations on how to finish this project up to make the back of the courthouse look respectable. If any of you have gone by and seen it, you'll see that there's it's like night and day between the existing stone and the stone that has been replaced on the south side. Their explanation as why it was left this way was on the back side of their letter, saying that it has continued to deteriorate since their initial field work was performed in 2007 and 2008. And as they were removing pieces of it, the existing stone that was supposed to remain was actually just falling apart just for the vibration of the stone that they were taking out. They came up with multiple recommendations, which are not in here, which are referred to. Recommendations, six different recommendations to resolve this issue. Their recommendation to accept pricing items 1, 3, and 5. Items 1 and items 1 and 2 are pertaining to the final pieces of decorative stone band at the sill level on the south end of the west side, where they replaced the stone to the south end and stopped about 6 or 8 pieces from the edge of the building, which was by design supposed to be patched. The recommendation was to consider going to replace that stone, deduct for not patching. They supplied us a price for that. And the second option was to provide patching to try to match it as was designed, with the options 1 and 2. There, the difference was roughly $4,000 between those two options. The third item they looked at was the thin decorative stone band on the south side, which is the stone above the ashlar, about 4 foot up into the start of the brick course, where they replaced 4 or 5 pieces on the south side and left the remaining. So their recommendation was to go ahead and remove that stone also and have it replaced with new. And the last item, items 5 and 6 on their recommendation, was to finish removing the large stone band at the second floor windowsill level on the south side and provide new as opposed to patching. I know that sounds like an awful lot without a diagram to show you, but it's very obvious if anyone would go to the south side of the building, you can take a look at it.
I guess I would describe it, first of all, at the lower level, there's a stone band that's about this wide that goes all the way around the building. And if you look at it from the front and down the west side, somewhere towards the south corner of the west side, you start seeing the deterioration. If you look across on the south side, there's just no question about it. It's just crumbled, just falling apart as bad as those of you who were on the committee when we very first went to the courthouse and would go up to that sandstone and it would crumble off in our hands. And then at the next story level up, there's a band that's about 8 inches, I guess I would say, wide. And that's the one Alan's talking about. That's at that upper level. And it's the same situation. As you come around the front and down the west side, it's fine. When you get to that south corner and all the way across the south side, you can see it just looks terrible. It just looks terrible. It's crumbling. The stones don't match. It's awful. Mr. James.
So the cost that's going to be added is the 40-some thousand?
I think the total cost is 75,000.
Okay. And I recall what you were talking about, Steve, when we went out there, but we looked that whole building over and they checked it all over. I just find it amazing at this point in time that we're talking about still having to add stuff to this building project. I mean, that building was gone over, I thought, at that point with a fine-tooth comb, and we were told that these are the things that need to be done. They'll be done right. We've checked everything. We've checked all the, you know, the mortar, the stone, the ledges. I don't understand why. And I'm reading this about the weather hitting it in that lapse of time. Well, my land, if the weather did that much damage in that lapse of time, something's wrong. But I don't know if I can support this. It seems like we keep adding to this project, and we need to stop it somewhere, in my mind.
I guess my reaction is not supporting it is leaving crumbling stone on the south side of the building. That's what it is. To prove the point that the architects didn't do the job that you would have expected them to do by telling us up front it's going to cost you $75,000 more. The other thing I guess I would observe is we completely changed the south side of the building. There was this awning structure and was over the door, and you know, you just didn't pay any attention to this banding on the south side the way that building looked before. That's all gone. The sheriff came in, and remember, that has changed the way the exits were, and we completely changed it. It is obvious now. If you look at that south side, it is obvious. It is obvious and ugly. Yes, Mr. Chair White.
I will support these changes, but I guess my concern is what happens next spring. Are they going to find more? Or
I think this is the end of the project.
Hopefully they
there are no other sides of the building. This is it.
Okay.
Mr. Nudo.
What is left in contingency?
Oh, we've got funds for this. We have funds for this.
There is money in the construction fund.
Mr. Smucker.
I think this is for Mr. Reinhart. What happens if we don't do this?
If we do not replace it, the first thing we would have to do is attempt to patch it. If we do not attempt to patch it, then it's going to continue to deteriorate and continue to fall off the face of the building, allowing more water and more moisture in, causing more damage.
Yes, Mr. James.
Are we going to have added A&E fees to this because they're going to have to redesign and redo the work on that?
I don't anticipate any at this time.
I mean, if they would, how do I say this quietly, admit that it was an oversight on their part, maybe I could be swayed to support this because I know the work needs to be done, and if we put it off, it's only going to get worse. But I just, I mean, I can't go along with always just shelling out someone else's money.
Betts.
I'm going to support the issue. We have spent millions of dollars on the new courthouse and the old courthouse. We built a tower. I have had nothing but compliments from the community in terms of how it looks, in terms of the tower, in terms of much of the inside. I don't like spending this money either, but I can't see just patching and having it fall apart after we've spent millions and millions of dollars. It's like buying Lincoln Continental and junking the thing because you've got a flat tire. It makes no sense.
I am American.
Other discussion? Mr. Smucker? Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Connor.
I was just going to be a little possessive with my comment. I don't want scabs next to our clock and bell tower.
Okay. Mr. J.
I won't belabor this, but I got to say this, Mr. Chairman, that we have spent millions of dollars for professional fees, and I'm not sure we're getting our money's worth. And this is a prime example of that.
Mr. Smucker.
Yeah. I guess I would. My concern too with this is that, you know, I've been on the facilities committee for a year, and I don't. I think we've had this situation come up now three or four times where it looks like we're done. We're sure that this is the last project, and then 2 months later, they find something else. Something else needs to be replaced, and so it's just a pattern. I'm just pointing out that there's this pattern that is going on where we continue to, have these new projects come back to us, and every time this is the last one, and then 3 months later there's something else that needs to be tucked or something. So, that's the concern that I have with this.
Mr. J.
Now that you've allowed me my concern, I don't think we have any choice but to go ahead and approve this and get this finished once and for all.
Any other discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. Lexington Building Update. Approval of agreement with IGW GHR for architectural engineering services for Lexington. What did I do?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I will make the motion.
I'm entertaining a motion to accept the report and recommendation to expend $75,994.36 as recommended by IGW in its letter dated December 29, 2009. Weidenberg and Oney, I'm sorry. December 29, 2009. Mr. Betts moves. Is there a second?
Second.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. Oh, Mr. Rosales. Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. Okay, approval of agreement with IGW GHR for architectural engineering services for election building project not to exceed $15,000. Entertain a motion to approve. Moved by O'Connor, second by Kurtz. Discussion. Does everybody understand this one? Ms. Ammons.
And I'm glad to be able to sit in this meeting with facilities, unlike normal scheduling. I had an opportunity to go over this one as well. And my question is, even though the project is seen not to exceed $15,000, that is for the engineer's fees, correct?
True.
That is not
architects and engineers.
That's the architect and engineer's fees. That is not the actual cost of the project.
That's correct.
And this project, as with the others, where would the money come from to include once they draw up the plan?
Ms. Busey.
Actually, facilities did approve this recommendation in November. It's just that we're bringing the actual contract to you now. So we were directed to proceed with getting the contract and not to exceed $15,000 for these services. The money that we had tentatively identified for this project would be in the capital asset facilities fund. The committee in November, when it approved this, did not say that they wanted to spend the money on the building, but they wanted to have the work done so that we could get the engineering, architectural engineering services to determine how to best use this building and what would be required to complete bringing it up to a standard where we can occupy it.
Anything else, Ms. Sims? Approve this.
A 15.
That's correct. This concept of architect engineering services not to exceed $15,000, we approved. This is the contract that brings that forward. But I thought your question was the larger one.
No,
how are we going to pay for the project? Okay. Mr. Sapp.
For the benefit of those who have not been in our meetings for the past couple of years that we've been discussing this, and we lost the building several years ago due to a storm, we received an insurance payment that we used the payment to try and divide that building up that we're speaking about currently between the sheriff and the county clerk. We've spent close to, I think, $100,000 on
over 100,
so
I think,
far.
By now. Yeah.
We only have $4,000 or so dollars left from the insurance payment. Now, and even spending that money, which back a year and a half or a year ago, we thought we had a design that was going to work. We spent $100,000, close to $100,000. Now we're coming back and paying A&E services to design the building even further. It's, again, it's one of those things. I think it's a money pit. We keep dumping money into it. I won't support it. It's just frustrating that we've already spent this money and still are nowhere close, I don't think, to a building that's suitable for the county clerk to use.
I will say that there, within the facilities committee, there has been a divide. There are those of us who believe that we never talked about the expenditure of funds for HVAC on this project. That's a major portion of the problem, is that because the county clerk will be storing equipment that has atmospheric sensitivity, we have to have a better HVAC system than is in there. There are members of the committee that believe that we already talked about that, and that was part of the discussion when we initially agreed to spend the insurance money to use the building the way that we were. There are those of us on the committee that went back and looked at minutes and said, no, we never talked about that. So you're sort of getting the flavor, the full board is getting the flavor of some of the disagreements that we've had in facilities. Mr. Sapp.
There is definitely a divide, and again, I'm one of those that feel that we've had this discussion, and we've discussed this building over over and over and over again. And if you look at the report, and I think we're putting the cart before the horse here a little bit, we're going to approve this contract for these services. And if you look at the report, it goes much further than just looking at air conditioning and heating. It goes into building walls. It goes into systems.
And I'll respond.
Doors that I thought we had in place with $100,000 that we put on there.
Absolutely correct, Mr. Sapp. And we couldn't get the county clerk to the building to meet with Mr. Reinhart to give us the programming, to tell us what he wanted inside that building. He had his duties. He had an election to run. I understand that he couldn't get there. He didn't get out there until April following the summer that we were there. He's now been there. We've done our programming with the architect. We all know now what it is. It's too bad we had this disagreement in the past. Let's deal with the issue that's in front of us. Mr. Nudo.
Yeah, in reviewing some of the specs that they want to have for this building, it sounds like the building is going to be occupied on 100% full-time basis because of temperature requirements for people and retiling bathroom floors, etc. I'm just wondering, if this is strictly for storage and the person or persons that have to go in there and work with it, as according to this write-up, a month and a half prior to the election, I just wonder if we're building a gilded lily here that may be less. I guess the specs here indicate to me that this is going to be a fully occupied building that you know, like 70 degrees in the winter and 75 degrees in the summer. We don't even do that here. Wow. So I guess, you know, my question is, the specs that we're given or who's working on this, is this really what we need for a storage building?
The county clerk has identified the special atmospheric environmental needs because of the warranties of the equipment, the special electronic equipment that he has. The situation where it is stored in another pod here and he has to move it into rooms and test it, that sort of thing, I can understand. It's just not acceptable to him. He needs a larger space. He needs a building like this building. We even had a tour on November 7th, and some of you folks actually came so that you could physically see this building and you'd understand it ain't going to work in the condition that it is.
What I'm asking is, you know, the specs that are we're talking about for storage of equipment that have atmospheric conditions, are the specs that we're looking at here germane to storage or to do a full-time?
They're germane to storage because of the nature of the equipment that's being stored. That's what we've been told, you know. I have no reason to doubt it.
A new tile floor finish will be provided in the toilet room. I mean, that's the questions I'm asking about that.
Well, I guess you'd have to look at the tile floor and the old tile floor and the floor in the toilet room, and you'd understand why the county clerk wants and thinks there ought to be a new tile floor in there. And I don't blame you.
I stand that I didn't go in there, so I probably should look at it. You're right.
Any other discussion? Okay. The only issue before us right now is to approve the contract for architect engineering services, and we'll move to the second one. Ms. Ammons.
Yes, I'd like to ask for a roll call on that vote.
Anybody else?
Sure.
Call the roll.
Ammons.
No.
Anderson.
Yes.
Beckett.
Yes.
Benzel. Betts.
Yes.
Coart.
Yes.
Dennis.
Yes.
Gladney.
Yes.
James.
Yes.
Jay.
Oh.
Jones.
Yes.
Knott.
Yes.
Kurtz.
Yes.
Michael.
Nudo.
Yes.
O'Connor.
Yes.
Richards.
Yes.
Rosales.
Yes.
Sapp.
No.
Schrader.
Yes.
Schmucker.
He's not here.
Okay. Wysocki.
Yes.
Weibel.
Yes.
Motion carries. You have the report from IGW of the nature of the work that they expect to have done in terms of specifications. So that work will be a bid, and we'll be bringing that back. Is that right? Or are you doing some of it? How are you handling that?
They will first investigate the rules and regulations, code violations that they have to address, and then we will, when we're able to continue installing the insulation and the sheeting on the inside of the exterior walls, and then we'll wait for them to finish design before we can go any further.
Okay. So this is an issue we'll come back to you with. Downtown parking station replacement update. This is what I talked about. Somebody talked about somebody going out of business. I call it, we have one-armed bandit at the courthouse. And, you know, you go in there just like the one in downtown Champaign, and you put a quarter in, it gives you an hour. And you put 50 cents in, another 50 cents in, it gives you another hour. We were supposed to get about, when the courthouse was opened up, we were supposed to get revenue of about $40,000 a year. Then, of course, we had Mr. Sapp and I were on the subcommittee, the great parking disaster of 2005 or whatever it was. And so we had to solve a problem of providing parking for the courthouse employees, and we did that by basically carving about half the spaces out of the parking in that lot. And so the exterior rim of the lot are either reserved for people in the building, or there's a lottery every year in downtown employees. If they win the lottery, they get a park right next to the building where they where they work. And then the rest of them, you know, park over by Save-A-Lot. Everybody understands that. Well, guess what? The station broke. And it's broke. It's been down many times, and we've always repaired it. But it's been broke since sometime in early December, I think. And it can't be repaired. The company went out of business. There are no parts. There's a sign up that says, out of order. Guess what happens when that occurs? Anybody guess?
Everybody parks for free.
Everybody in the courthouse parks in that lot. Even though we're providing spaces up on Save-A-Lot, nobody's collecting any revenue. It doesn't cost anything. Right. So it's cold. It's cold, right? You're going to park right next to the building. So that means when the other users of the courthouse, the public and the attorneys and folks that come there to do work, come into play, there's no place for them to park. And they'll have to go out and try to find a place on the street. So it's not a happy scene for us, and we're losing revenue. I think we're probably $20,000. I think we've been averaging about $20,000 a year off that lot after the Beckett Sapp. He doesn't like to have it called that. The Beckett Sapp parking plan went into play. We're losing money every day, and we have a real problem, and it seems to me that there's really only one or two companies that sell those kind of machines, right? And so we need to, with your approval, and I guess that's what I'm looking for is a consensus here, we need to go out and search for a replacement machine. And you've got any idea what kind of money we're talking about? Isn't it like $15,000 or something?
Anywhere
like that?
From $10,000 to $15,000.
Chair Weibel.
Is the one-armed bandit in Champaign, do they have the same problem there, or is that a different company?
Different company. Mr. Jay.
We had quite a discussion one time about putting it inside and get it out of the weather.
It is.
It is inside and still didn't work.
It is out of the weather, and it just broke down. It's mechanical, and it broke down. And the problem is the company went out of business. We have no way of getting parts for it. So in the past, when it broke down, we'd be able to call a representative of the company. They'd come in, they'd maintain it and repair it, and we'd get it back up and running. They don't exist anymore.
A follow-up then, if I might. What would it cost us to put parking meters in there?
Don't know. We can check that as an option. It would be run by... You'd have to, in essence, enter into an intergovernmental agreement with Urbana to put parking meters in there.
We got law enforcement in the building every day.
Yeah, but that lot is serviced by Urbana already.
But it's our lot.
It is our lot.
And we can have it serviced by whomever we want, I would assume.
Well, the difference is... if we buy the meters, then we got to run them. They are our meters, and we got to run them, just like the machine is ours. If Urbana puts the meters in, then they're going to want the revenue from the meters. And the way the agreement we had, they got the fines, and we got the money.
They got the money, and we got the shaft. That's what you're really saying.
We actually got money off this.
I'm not sure that a meter would work, but I'd at least like to look at it.
Okay. Okay, Mr. James?
I'm going to have to say that I think we need to look at all of our options, and even though they're getting free parking, the money we've spent on that thing, and I can remember the breakdowns, I remember all the discussions, and I was dead set. At that time, I said, we got to come up with a better way, because Mr. Reinhart and his crews, that thing was jamming, everything was going wrong, and then I was told that, well, we put it in a big, nice area and protect it, and it's going to last, and they said this and said that, and here we are talking about it again. Heck, put up a little shack out there and have some guy there with a whistle like they do at Christie Clinic and charge those folks when they come in and let him work the gate and give somebody a job. But spending all this money is crazy, but let's think about it and let those folks park for free because they pay taxes anyway.
At the next meeting, we'll have a report for you that shows you the revenue and the expenses that we've had over the years on that lot. And that reminds me, Mr. Richards, you're going to be here next month because I'm at a judicial conference. Yes.
How many parking meters does the county own right now?
How many
parking meters do we own right now?
None.
Okay.
Yeah.
Every month we don't do this, we're losing revenue.
Right.
And our intent was that we would bring to you a budget amendment at the finance meeting next month so that we could proceed with this replacement. Next week. So I just want to make sure we're all aware we're delaying this by, you know.
All right. So we're probably losing $2,000.
Yeah, each month you lose that $2,000.
Yeah, but we don't do it.
We could bring the parking meter information probably to finance as well.
Okay. Mr. Richards.
I don't disagree with the premise that we need to replace this, but could you refresh my memory? It seems like we just replaced that thing. When was that?
No, we put the shelter.
The shelter?
Yeah. That's the last thing we did there. We put the shelter over. Well, anybody want us to do anything?
Have we made any money net of expenditures?
Have we what?
Have we actually made any money net of expenditures?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
It's a $20,000 a year revenue line.
Yeah, but we've been there, what, 4 years? We've bought and
well, we've been there since 2002. There.
Yeah.
Two machines and a hut.
Mr. Sapp.
Deb, you mentioned the budget amendment. Where is that going to come out of? Or is
the general corporate fund balance.
There's money. Cover an expenditure up to $15,000.
Yeah, and it's under the purchasing policy requirements for bidding or anything, so it just would be a purchase. But we would want to amend the budget.
For a motion.
Yeah.
Motion to have Alan look into it and recommend the replacement of that machine.
All right. So a second. Second by Richards. Ms. Ammons?
Is that motion including the installation or just the purchase?
Oh, it's the whole thing.
The whole thing.
Including installation. Mr. Schmucker?
Could I ask if we could add as a friendly amendment to also explore the parking meter option by next by the Finance Committee?
Sure.
So that we've got all the information.
Are you opposed to that, Mr. Richards? Mr. Sapp? Okay. Mr. Nudo.
Hey, Steve, clarify again, the city of Urbana, if they had the meters installed there, they would get the revenue and the fines?
Yes.
Well,
if we let them put it on our lot.
If we let them put it on, but certainly you can negotiate to trade out additional parking space for employees, et cetera, free. I mean, there's things that we could do. We if we did that, there's no way we would accept that kind of a premise unless we got some quid pro quo on parking somewhere else.
Would you like to be the chair of the parking subcommittee?
I love to negotiate.
Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Director of Reports. Facility Director Reports. Mr. Reiner.
On page 63 of your agenda, these are monthly reports we've been supplying to the Facilities Committee for several years now. Page 63, it shows the basic gas and water service, electric service, and the seven major building repair and maintenance light items. The third column, fiscal year 2009 budgeted, is the updated budget showing currently what our budget for each this year is up to and the remaining balance in the column on the far right. We supply this strictly for information only. You'll see that for the courthouse repair and maintenance line items, we have downtown jail repair and maintenance, the satellite jail repair and maintenance, the the difference between the jail, which are 24-hour buildings, and the standard 8 to 10-hour day buildings, there's quite a bit of difference in the maintenance of it, where it works out from roughly 25 cents a square foot for a office building complex, and close to 50 to 60 cents per square foot for a 24-hour facility. So this is how we just try to keep a general idea on how our repair and maintenance line items are going throughout the year. And each month it's updated. We will finish, have one more report at the end next month for the end of 2009 as we finalize our records.
Any questions for Mr. Reinhart? Mr. Richards.
Are bills still coming in for fiscal year 2009?
Yes, they are.
But I will say it looks like we are under budget on all these line items. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank
hope you.
We
stay that way.
Yes. Right, because he sets the rates. Yes, that's our wild guess at what utility rates would be. That shows how good we are. Yes.
Could you indicate what kinds of things are under all other services?
All other services.
Well, it's got gas, electric, water, sewer, and then all other services is like $287,000. I just wondered why.
Waste disposal would be another one. Other commodities that we have to deal with, like mops, mop handles, brooms, vacuum cleaners, all kinds of miscellaneous items, all the way across the board from grounds repair to custodians and maintenance.
Thank you.
Ms. Ammons. There a second?
Second.
Second by Chair Weibel. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Capital projects.
Okay. At the end of each year, we are requested by the auditor's office to supply them with an update for the capital improvement projects that we perform throughout the year. They use this information to update their records to make sure that the value of each building stays current. So this is once again information we just supplied to you to see that these are projects that we have completed through the fiscal year 2009.
Any questions? Entertain a motion to receive and place on file.
So moved.
Moved by James, second by Ammons. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. I have no other report. Is there any other business for facilities? I should say rumblings from lawyers unhappy about things at the courthouse, and hopefully I'll have a report on things that we've been able to do to make lawyers happy at little cost. We'll see. As far as I could tell, there was not an item that passed unanimously. items 1 and 2, those are not full board items. Those would have just been committee items, right? Or the amendment, that would go to full board, right?
Okay.
Right, so A2 goes to full board, A1 would not. C1 would go to full board. And there's nothing under it. That's basically it, right? All right. That's all from facilities. Thank you.
Okay, next we have the Environment and Land Use Committee. Mr. Hall will be joining us. First up, we have two recreation and entertainment licenses for renewal. Chair would entertain an omnibus motion to accept.
Second.
Motion by Mr. Betts with a second from Mr. Kurtz. Any discussion?
This one did not get here, so we only have one.
Oh. Mr. Hall informs me that you don't have any information regarding the Stagecoach at Gordyville, so we're really only doing the Mahomet Alto Vineyards. I assume theirs will be coming next month?
Yes, this is the first year that business has applied for an annual license. They normally get temporary licenses, and so they just were not familiar with the deadline, and that should be before you next month.
Okay, thank you. Any discussion on the remaining license? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next item is property maintenance complaints and relevant county ordinances and codes. Mr. Hall.
At your table tonight is a new memo with new information. The information is of two types. Number one, I was asked to do a review of other jurisdictions, and so the second page of the new memo shows a brief review of other selected Illinois counties, and for three municipalities in our own county, Champaign, Urbana, and Rantoul, it indicates which jurisdictions have nuisance ordinance, which have zoning, which have building codes, property maintenance codes, and rental inspection programs. And the first page of the memo has four bullets. McLean County does not have a nuisance ordinance. All the other counties have a nuisance ordinance, and neither McLean nor Champaign County have building codes, but the other counties there have all adopted building codes, and of those five counties, Macon is the only one that has not adopted a property maintenance code. Champaign, Urbana, and Rantoul each have building codes and property maintenance codes. Urbana and Rantoul are the only two of those who have seen fit to have a regular inspection program for rental units. Champaign only responds to complaints. And the last page of this new memo is a revised summary of enforcement activities for the past 18 months. We found some incorrect numbers in the report that went out in the agenda, and we updated it, but it doesn't really change any of the general trends. But I did want you to have the correct numbers.
Mr. James.
I've fielded several calls, which I know I've talked with Barb and Mr. Hall on some of the issues, but there seems to be in general out in the county areas where there are apartment buildings and or homes that may be rented, a lot of the tenants seem to think that there's nobody they can turn to when life safety issues and other building codes are not where they need to be. And I know, and I agree, when a tenant enters into a lease, they need to be aware of what they're signing and getting into. But in my mind, it doesn't relieve a landlord to meet the bare necessities, such as carbon monoxide testers, what have you. And I would think that since the property is within our jurisdiction in the rural areas, that the zoning department should have some sort of enforcement tool to bring these properties up to the standards they need to be, without being as rigid as some of these others that have been brought forth, such as Urbana and maybe even Rand Tools. But I think there needs to be an outlet for people, and even if it's a complaint-based outlet, then enforcement can be done, and then maybe even some sort of ordinance passed that would allow the zoning department to recoup their time and effort by having a fee in place that they could assess the landlord for making a visit to their property to make sure they're in compliance.
Ms. Ammons?
Since coming on to the board, and I received two calls, and they weren't in the rural areas. They were just really on the outskirts of the... complaint was usually about large amounts of... tenant, and the landlord may live in another city. And so the neighbors were complaining, but each time they said that there was no enforcement or very slow enforcement. And so I think that without some direction and some guidelines, an ordinance that would tie some fiscal responsibility to the landlord, in that case, these things just look at the numbers and how many complaints. Only four of them may have made it to the state's attorney's level at this point, but others could be solved with some type of fee attached to those. And I think that the committee should consider looking at some structures for this so that there is a fine and fee where our either fill these calls and complaints or go out physically and see the complaint that is being called in. And so I would be in support of an ordinance being passed on this issue.
Mr. Schrader?
Mr. Hall, is it feasible to have... thank you for your chart you presented to us tonight on our desk, outline the programs throughout the county and other jurisdictions. Is it feasible to have a property maintenance code without a building code? And if so, or if not, can you tie in the state building code in some way that will suffice it to make the property maintenance code work?
I don't believe it's feasible to try to have a property maintenance code without a building code, and as far as tying in a property maintenance code to the state building code, I don't think that would be good, because we need to have enforcement based on a building code, I believe, in order to really have an enforceable property maintenance code. So if I understood your question, I don't think either one of those approaches would be very good. Could I add one thing, John?
Absolutely.
In light of the article that was in the Rantoul Press about this apartment complex, I mean, I didn't realize, when we were there in April, I didn't realize people would be using their ovens to heat their apartment with in the winter. That's a dangerous building if you've got to do that. I've asked the state's attorney if we could, I mean, at your direction, could we beef up our nuisance ordinance to include some specific examples of what are dangerous buildings? And they believe we could. Now, if we do that and we get more complaints, I don't want you to think that we're going to get every complaint answered exactly as it comes in. We're still trying to get our backlog of old complaints cleared up. But on dangerous buildings, I mean, I would hope we could do a pretty good job. But anyhow, one way to address dangerous buildings is just beef up our nuisance ordinance and then see how that works. That would be one alternative.
But I know we're discussing mostly the multifamily type dwellings, what we're probably really concerned with right now, but we know throughout the county there's also single family dwellings, there's mobile homes also that are rental units also, and I wonder if that could be under the same impact as the multifamily units.
If you want us to take on that challenge, it could be, but I got to tell you, I have no idea how many complaints we would be receiving at that point. And it just may be almost a challenge too far.
Mr. Nudo, do you have a question? Mr. Weibel?
Well, perhaps you could talk to some of the people in the LA counties who have a nuisance or have a beefier nuisance ordinance to find out what kind and how many calls they get, like you just talked about.
Well, our nuisance ordinance is already the beefiest I've seen.
Oh, never mind.
And it needs to be better.
Well, what about if they have a building code, so the same thing, except in those kinds they applied to building code. Is that possible to find out the number of calls they get about that? To say this other county has the same problem, but they have a building code in the county where people can complain about, you know, a house falling down or something like that.
So you're wondering if we could find out literally how many complaints they get?
Right.
Just sure, we could do that.
For example, yeah, pick a county that looks like it'd be a good comparison and do that.
That shouldn't take a long time.
Mr. James?
Well, some of the complaints I got were also near Marketplace Mall in that area, and when I look at some of the neighborhoods and some of the homes have been rented out, they've become rental property, there's abandoned vehicles, again what Carol Ammon said, there's stains that have been there for quite some time, but I've always believed that if we're proactive and look for solutions and get in there fast and do what is expected of us or what the general public thinks we are supposed to do, it helps. I've seen our community in Rantoul just fall apart. I mean, we had things in place, but now we've geared up and we're trying to do what we need to do. But in the meantime, we saw neighborhoods just go to the wayside. And it's all because people think, well, building codes is doing this or zoning's doing this. And nobody was. Nobody was enforcing it. And I just think we need a mechanism. Do I think we ought to have something really stringent that says, oh, your grass can't be over 3 inches? No, that's ludicrous. But, yeah, we need to be mindful that, you know, we're here to serve the people. That's what we're here to do. And we collect taxes and what have you. But I was always under the impression, and here I sit on this county board, that the zoning department, like I live out in the rural area, that if I called, my neighbor's roof was falling down and shingles were all over the place, that zoning would step in and say, hey, you've got X amount of days to get this cleaned up. It's a hazard. But they don't. And if we don't get a handle on it, the way this county's growing, and I know I have fellow Republicans here that they live in the rural areas, and I know living in the rural areas is a plus because, you know, we can burn trash, we can do crazy things that you can't do in town, but we got to be mindful that some of these buildings that are sitting there, and some of the ones we're talking about, that if they become abandoned, they become a place for crime and other problems that lead to more tax money because of the sheriff and other things that go in with that. So I'm just saying we need to, and also the responsibility to the people we serve, that, yeah, we're doing the best we can and we're providing the basic needs that you're supposed to have and that are required to have by law.
Mr. Nudo and then Mr. Gladney.
You know, my concerns are twofold, John. I guess I'm encouraged to see the research you've done on other counties showing that there are property maintenance code and building codes in the majority of them. But I'm also concerned about the ability to get after those issues that are truly life safety, because somebody is going to die in the properties that we saw in April. Somebody is going to die. I just know that particular landlord had a property in Champaign that acquired 670 violations when they did get a zoning. One property had 670 violations. Surely we can find something that would, you know, preserve life. But when I look at some numbers here on the complaints that we were received, we have two people on staff, and I don't know exactly what their full duties are, but if I look at from 6-1 to 12-1, two people, assuming 5 days a week, only 4 weeks in a month instead of 4.3, that's 120 days times 2 is 240. These complaints, 240, you have 240 work days to address 175 complaints. That's 0.73, three-quarters of one complaint a day. Or from a solving, from a solution basis, you've said we've solved, or at least on the process of solving, it's 0.55. So about half of a complaint a day is being solved. You know, you can write up anything you want, but if we're not going to get after what Stan's saying, somebody is going to die. And so I don't know what the standards are in these other counties as to how many complaints they address a day, but we surely ought to get that information too and see how many are resolved in a five-month period.
Mr. Betts?
You know, we have this issue before us, but it seems to me in part one of the things we might be able to do without all of the complexity, at least initially, is adopt a basic habitability statement that a piece of property from October 15th to April 15th of each and every year must have heat that registers at 62 degrees 5 inches from the floor. It must have running water, must have roofs, you know, four things at a minimum as a county statement. And the enforcement issue really becomes if that's not been complied with, since we have a state repair and deduct act and the right of constructive eviction, that the tenant can repair. Now, granted, most of the tenants don't have a lot of money, but they can do that if we adopt a habitability statement. They can vacate the premises if it doesn't meet that standard. Now, there'll be a lawsuit by the landlord, so I spend my life doing, but you can win those lawsuits where they haven't met that habitability code. You don't have to have a huge building code to do it. You have to have a minimum statement of what you expect. Until such time as we do adopt a building code, or the state does it for us. But it seems to me heating is basic. Heat should be available from April 15th to October. Reverse that. That's a minimum. There should be screens on windows. It should not leak. There should be ingress and egress for fire safety purposes. Those things do not take a massive building code to do. It can be done in a relatively simple statement of habitability on the part of the county.
Mr. Jay?
I've been in great debate with one of my colleagues here in the back row about some properties that's been neglect. I hope you all realize that however you want to approach this, whether it's with building codes or with what Tom just described, which makes some sense to me, it's going to take money. And I'm not sure that this county is in a position right now to take that on. Now, we can argue whether it's the right thing to do and whether we ought to maybe shut down one of the jails or do something to generate the money. I don't have a clue, but it's not going to be cheap. The other thing, one of these people that's propagated this in the county has also done it in Champaign, and here's Champaign with all the codes in the world. And it's still going on in Champaign. So let's, as Tom had indicated, I don't think codes in itself is strictly the answer. So I think we need to be very careful before we jump off the cliff. I don't want anybody freezing to death. I don't want anybody dying in the house. But I guarantee it's going to happen whether we have codes or whether we don't have codes.
Mr. Betts?
So in terms of the habitability statement that I'm thinking about, when we passed in the legislature a statewide repair and deduct act a few years ago, it has not been easy to apply in Champaign County because we don't have any statement of habitability. Whereas you do have that in Champaign and Urbana. In fact, for three decades we've had repair and deduct in the city of Urbana, and the state caught up to Urbana and Evanston and Bloomington and the city of Chicago. I've actually tried cases on constructive eviction where there has not been a building code. So it actually can be done. You can do it testimonially from your tenant saying there is not heat in December and it's 20 below zero. That's a habitability issue. The problem we have in a lot of tenancies in the community is people are very poor living there. They don't have another spot to live. So getting them out of the lease doesn't always solve the problem because we don't have a lot of affordable housing in the community in general. But I think at a minimum, even if we just address the heat issue and said it's the policy of Champaign County that heat shall be available from this period to that period, that's a start. And that we don't have to fine landlords or anything else. We can make that as a statement, and then they can sue the landlord. Land of Lincoln or my office or private attorneys could potentially sue the landlord. I do think we do need to take some form of action at some point.
I recognize Ms. Ammons, but I want to ask my question before, because I have a tendency to forget them. Is there anything in state statute that gives counties emergency powers in situations of dire necessity? I mean, we're talking 4 to 6 inches of snow this weekend on top of sub-zero temperatures. I don't believe that an oven is enough to warm those individuals in the housing unit we're all referring to here.
I'm not aware of the county having any powers other than we can send a notice and take somebody to court. But that's one thing that I've asked the state's attorney to help me with.
Mr. Gladney, I'm sorry, I overlooked you. Go ahead.
It's okay, Mr. Nudo said what I was going to say.
Okay. Mr. Kurtz.
Mr. Hall.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to recognize Ms. Ammons. Go ahead.
I think you were alluding to my question. That's just pointed out as he expressed the habitability statement. I'm wondering if it would have... what we saw in not just this property, but a couple of properties prior, had issues, environmental issues, no water, no power, all the people.
And so I'm they don't
have anything to use. So I'm wondering if, especially in the other counties, structural in the other building codes. And I'd like to know that when you bring this back.
Mr. Kurtz.
Mr. Hall, I have a question. In Champaign City, when a property deteriorates, when there's weeds or overgrown or automobiles that are sitting on property, the city has the power to go in, remove and repair, I guess, that property, and then bill the owner for it. I've seen that happen a couple of times in the city. Could we have that kind of power? Like, let's say, in an emergency situation, there are people here who have no heat. We go in, repair the heat, and bill the owner. Is that feasible?
The county administrator is a better judge of whether that's feasible.
We'll go there.
The city of Champaign is home rule, which makes a huge difference. And I'm not sure the statutes give the county that kind of leverage or ability, but it's something that we would have to look into from a legal perspective.
I know in regards to dangerous structures, if the county wants to pay for the removal of a dangerous structure and can pay, you can certainly do that. But again, that takes resources, and how long will it take to recoup those resources? We demolished a building in Dobbins Downs back in 2001, and we still haven't recouped any of our costs from that. So I assume that's a very limited approach for the county.
Well, I was saying, but something in an emergency situation, like when we're talking about people's lives and heating, I mean, heating is a serious situation, like what's going to happen this weekend and what's been happening for the past couple of weeks. If we had some kind of power to go in and just alleviate the problem, at the very least temporarily for them until the spring, I'm just saying maybe it's something that we wouldn't have to spend months and months and months on, but something that just go in and do something about it. And if we have to put space heaters or something in there just to keep their homes warm or whatever, if we have that kind of authority.
Mr. James?
I don't know. You know, I'd like to see this just sort of progress and see draft, as Tom was saying, something simple to where tenants do have some rights and lawyers can step in on their behalf. If we start taking on a lot of these other areas, there's so much gray area there because you have to give the landlord a chance to respond. You can't just go in and say, hey, this heat's out, we're going to put furnace in or a space heater. There could be a lot of, you know, other things that were involved in that before that step needs to be taken. But if what I was looking at is give the department or draft some type of ordinance to give the basic things we need to have addressed so people do feel a little bit secure. Again, I stress, even all of us, when we buy a car or whatever we get, we don't know what might be wrong with that until we drive it or have it. So when a tenant signs a lease, they're taking it on face value that somebody has looked at that and they have made sure everything's going to work and do what they're supposed to do. But water, sewage, heat, electricity, the basic needs should be met. The codes such as smoke alarms, COs. But if anything, we should have the power, again, to make the landlord do it and have some type of fee structure for our time going out there. Or like they do in the village of Rantoul, condemn the property so the tenant has a right to get out of there and break their lease and not be on the hook for a year or two. But I'm just looking at some simple tools to help folks to do that. But no, do I want to sit there, and I'm going to choose my words carefully and get in trouble anyway, I don't want to babysit people because that's why we're adults. They need to know that they have to do research and do the right thing. We're not here to just always hold them by the hand, but yes, we're going to give them the tools to do what's right.
Do you want Mr. Betts and then Mr. Knott?
I appreciate what Mr. James has said because I agree with much of what he's saying. I think that building codes are imperfect in Champaign and Urbana and Chicago. I would like to have seen us have a proper building code decades ago in countywide. It's not going to happen real soon. But there, again, I think there's some interim things that could be done. Even having a habitability statement regarding sewage, etc., it's a step. That would be a minimum step. It does not solve the problem, because the real problem is people will rent from unscrupulous landlords with buildings that are in dilapidated condition because that's their only choice. That's the big problem we have in this community. It's not just here. It's all over the country. There's a lack of safe, affordable housing for people of low and moderate income. That's the real problem that we face. If these people had money right now, they would not be living in a place that didn't have heat.
Mr. Knott?
I'd like to motion that we receive and place these on file and move on.
Second.
Motion's been made to put on file the property maintenance complaints and the relevant county ordinances. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Monthly reports.
Also at your table tonight was a monthly report for November, and stapled to the front of it is a summary report for fiscal year 09. And I'll just quickly review the summary of fiscal 09. The county adopted zoning in October 1973, and this year, 2009, was the lowest number of both zoning cases and zoning permits in the 36 years of county zoning. On the bright side, that has let us make some progress on backlog of compliance inspections and enforcement cases. So we are trying to do the best we can with the time we have. The other thing that the slack in zoning cases let us do is focus 2 entire months at the ZBA on the wind farm ordinance. And we got that done. In a normal year, the ZBA taking 2 months to focus on a major amendment like that would be a bit of a problem. As far as permits, yeah, it's the lowest permitting in 36 years, but we've done almost 500 compliance inspections this year, getting caught up on that. We're ending the year with fewer backlog of unresolved enforcement cases than we started the year with, and that's the first time that's happened for 10 years. We're going to try to do better next year. So that's it in a nutshell. It doesn't sound like much, but it takes a lot of work over the course of the year to just achieve that much. If you have any questions or if there's other things that you want, I can bring more information next month.
Mr. Nudo?
Just to reiterate, my request is if you can get similar reports from other counties to see exactly where they stand on these kinds of responses and complaint fulfillments. I'd like, if we could.
Is there a motion to place these the summary report on file? Motion by Mr. Weibel, seconded by Mr. Knott. Any other discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The only item from the chair is a reminder to members of the board that beginning on January the 11th, the public comment period begins regarding the LRMP. This will continue for 30 days and take us into February 9th. And also be aware that the public meeting regarding LRMP is set for January the 26th, which is a Tuesday, from 4 to 7 at the Holiday Inn in North Urbana. Apparently, ELOC has nothing to go to the board.
Correct.
Okay. Any other business? If not, I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Somebody made a motion and Mr. James seconded. All those in favor? Motion carries. Thank you.